Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast, where you learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secured retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in, because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. I'm Big Mike, and today's episode is unique. I don't have a guest, but what I do have is a summary of the great concepts that we've talked about over the last number of months. So I wanted to take advantage of this opportunity to chat about some of the real basic and really great concepts to give my listeners an opportunity to review and reflect on investing, speculation, return on time, return on investment, cash flow versus appreciation, and many other concepts. So if you've just tuned in, please take your time and enjoy this episode. So let's start by talking a little bit about investing versus speculation versus gambling. Many of us have gone to Vegas, have played the roulette, played other games. We know what is gambling. Gambling is fun. It is something that we shouldn't do on a long-term basis because the house has an edge. And over time, you're guaranteed to lose. So the moment you start gambling with your investment money, you start losing it. Let's now look at the investment. Benjamin Graham and Warren Buffett prescribe to pretty much the same investment philosophy, and I love that investment philosophy, and I follow it. So investment must have safety. That's the basic foundation of the investing into anything. It's got to have a reasonable degree of safety, in many ways a strong degree of safety, and then a reasonable rate of return. Those are the basic definitions of an investment. Then there's another category called speculation. And I'm leaving gambling alone now. Gambling is just not good in general when you talk about investing. Speculation is investing in Bitcoin, investing in high-flying, what used to be called dot-com or technology or biotech or high-tech, internet tech stocks that have no cash flow, they're probably losing money on paper, but they have some tremendous opportunity if they discover a new miracle drug, or if they discover a new technology, or their user base starts generating income in the future. That's speculation. Essentially, these investments don't have high degree of safety, nor do they have reasonable rate of return. However, they can produce phenomenal results. So if you're a classic investor, a value investor, you probably want to stay away from speculating. At the same time, you might want to do it for fun. Take a little bit of your money and you could speculate with, and you could even gamble with. You can go to Vegas and have a great time. So from that perspective, there's nothing wrong with speculation and nothing wrong with gambling. But as both of these categories should not be used for investment of your primary investable capital. And there are all kinds of interesting kind of speculation and gambling systems. And I had a recent conversation with a good friend, and she's a brilliant Harvard lawyer. And sometimes it amazes me that a brilliant person could be almost naive. So she's been day trading lately, and she's a phenomenal, bright person, and will leave her name anonymous. And she's had a great success with day-to-day trading. And she asked me the question, why can't I basically use the progressive betting on investment system, putting in a dollar, and if I lose, I put $2, and if I lose, I put $4, and if I lose, I put $8, and so on and so forth. That system works in the short run, and very often the system will work over a long period of time until the day of reckoning comes and she'll lose all the investment capital. That's the primary risk. The return is fairly small. There is a potential risk of catastrophic loss of capital, losing all of the money that she has when she hits a really bad run. So from that perspective, these type of progressive systems, they may appear to be appealing, but they're not investment either. They are essentially trading systems, and they could work in the short run. And there are plenty of successful day traders. But again, day traders, they don't invest, they speculate, just to be clear. So I wanted to cover this subject because lots of people think of these markets as markets for trading. And I don't disagree with you. When the markets show volatility, it's an opportunity for traders. It's an opportunity to take advantage of short-term market swings if you know what you're doing. So my response to her was, I hope you found your calling. Instead of doing law, you could day trade. And if you have a great system, you could do a whole lot better than being a lawyer. So she's enjoying it for now. At least that's important. The second topic for discussion is return on investment versus return on time, or combination of the both, ROI and ROT. Many of us think of the investment purely as investment of capital. Return on investment is what we look for. What is the annualized rate of return? 10%, 5%, 12%. But what we ignore often is the return on time. We forget about it. We're just too busy. We don't think a little bit about it. And what happens is it could be a significant drain on your personal time to manage your investments. So imagine you buy a business and the business needs your active participation. And return on investment on the capital that you could that you put in could be great. But return on your time could be pretty weak. I just had an opportunity to invest in a business coming across my desk. And I looked at it, and the business looked too small. The return on investment could be good. If the price is good, there could still be an upside in the business. But the problem is the business is small, and the return on time is likely to be pretty low. So from that perspective, it's critically important for you to consider what would be the return on time. So think of it this way. Let's just say you're going to invest 100 hours into something. And you're going to generate $10,000. And let's just say you invested $100,000 of your money. So you got 10% return on investment, $10,000 return on $100,000 capital investment. But you also had to invest 100 hours of your time. So you spend essentially working for $100 an hour and generated 0% return on your investment. Or you earn $0 an hour and you generate 10% of your investment. I hope this makes sense. Conceptually, it's misleading to just think of investment as a return on investment without considering the return on your time. There are purely passive investments where your time is not required and they generate just strong returns, and those are the best. If an investment presents an opportunity to generate high return on investment and high return of time, those are uniquely best opportunities, and if you find a good one, you could generate often 20-30% return on investment and good return on your time. These opportunities do exist from time to time, but they're not common. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that so at least you're aware of the concept. And I like to think of this as set your minimum. If you're working, you're worth $100 an hour, $50 an hour, $1,000 an hour, whatever it is, the return on time for whatever the opportunity that you are undertaking should be good, as well as return on investment. The third concept that I'd like to talk about is investing for cash flow versus investing for appreciation. They often go together. Cash flow doesn't have to be without appreciation, and appreciation doesn't have to be without a cash flow. But most of the investments have both elements. When you go and buy dividend paying stock. Let's use an example of Microsoft. They pay you dividends, they pay you income. At the same time, there is appreciation potential. But you don't know that the appreciation will happen. So the appreciation piece is speculative. The cash flow piece is likely to be more or less secure, especially if they have a history of the payouts of good dividends. So from that perspective, investing in dividend producing stocks with long history of payouts is generally a pretty solid strategy. The same is true in real estate. And I wanted to point this out because in real estate, you can generate often better cash flow than some of the market-leading dividend-paying stocks. So the cash flow in real estate could be a whole lot better. On top of that, there could be strong appreciation. And appreciation has two components. This is very important. So there is natural appreciation that happens as a result of inflation, as a result of market going up in a given area. And natural appreciation could be negative, so the markets can go down. So natural appreciation is not a guarantee. It's sort of a historic trend, but the trend can change. The other component of the appreciation is forced appreciation. Forced appreciation is something that's often far more valuable than the natural appreciation. Because the natural appreciation could be 6% a year. Let's just say that's the number that we've heard about, and that's an average across the United States for many, many years. If you look at the historic average, 6% is probably the right number. A forced appreciation could be 30%, 40%, 20%. It could be significantly higher. And forced appreciation happens as a result of the value add work that gets done on a specific property. So what is value add? Value add is simply renovations, increases of the rents, built out, redevelopment, any kind of improvement to the property that adds value to the property that increases cash flow are typically known as value add. So the classic example is taking a multifamily apartment complex and renovating units, and as they get renovated, increasing rents. That's the most basic value add that you could possibly observe out there. So looking at the forced appreciation plus natural appreciation is what typically produces the total appreciation. So for real estate projects with good forced appreciation plus a strong cash flow are typically best type of projects. In essence, you have your cake and you can actually eat it. So you have both some immediate gratification to the cash flow and growth of your capital over time through forced appreciation and some natural appreciation. When we invest, we actually look for forced appreciation a lot more than we look for natural appreciation. Natural appreciation happens great, but as long as there's forced appreciation, we love those projects. Now let's take another look at the real estate as a unique asset class that is more advantaged based on a tax code, based on bank rules and financeability than anything out there. Majority of us prefer to invest in the stock market. And stock market, there's nothing wrong with the stock market. The stock market has done fairly well over many, many, many years. And if you look at the historic average returns in the stock market over the last, say, 40 years, maybe longer, I think they've hovered around 10, 11%. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's actually a very good number if you combine both income, dividends distributions, as well as appreciation. Real estate can actually generate returns higher than that. And it has done with leverage over the last same period of time. So the natural appreciation of properties in real estate has been 6%. If you add just cash flow alone in most markets, you have done above your 10, 11%. But if you added mortgage leverage in addition to the natural cash flow and appreciation, you often can generate strong double-digit returns in real estate. So let's talk a little bit about real estate unique benefits. So the first unique benefit of real estate is cash flow. You own a property, you generate $1,000 a month in rent for the sake of a discussion. You pay taxes and insurance of, say, $200 a month. You pay some maintenance, and then you pay the mortgage, and you wind up with $300 a month cash flow. So $1,000 a month minus PITI, principal, interest, taxes, insurance, you have $300 a month, and that's your cash flow. Cash flow can happen from owning the properties. Cash flow can happen from lending on properties. Cash flow can happen from other real estate-related contracts, but we're talking about the basics for now. So cash flow is the number one benefit. The number two benefit is appreciation. We talked about it. Appreciation is often the tide that rises all boats, but the forced appreciation is the forced tide. You just raise the water and your boat has gone up while everybody else's boat is still sitting on the bottom of the bay. And the next benefit is depreciation. Depreciation is simply a tax write-off benefit that IRS has granted to real estate as a unique asset class. Stocks don't get to be depreciated. They may have their own depreciation schedules for the companies on the assets that they purchase and the equipment, But in general, if you buy stock, you can't depreciate your investment. In real estate, you bought something for $100,000, you could put a depreciation schedule and get immediate tax write-offs. So depreciation is unique to real estate. It is not something that you see in stock market. Amortization of the mortgage. So amortization is something that you get to enjoy. It's an additional paper income, essentially. You're basically paying down the mortgage. You don't see that as income, but over time, it builds wealth. You're paying down your debt. So it works like income that you don't see. Your cash flow is what you get in your pocket. But in addition to the actual cash flow, you get the amortization, mortgage pay down as a benefit. It's your income, the cash income plus the mortgage pay down income. It's an equivalent of income per se. And then the last component is the leverage. And the leverage is extremely powerful. It does work both ways, but a good positive leverage can magnify your returns. So you could have in a natural appreciating market at 6% per year, you could add another 6, 7, 8% of additional leveraged appreciation because of the debt finance and mortgage concept. So let's look at it this way. You could have a market where 6% appreciation with 75% mortgage, and your return on equity because of a leverage could be 15%, could be 13%, in addition to the, say, 7% cash flow. So your annualized total return on real estate could be 20%. It is nothing out of ordinary. It does happen sufficiently often. It doesn't happen in every case. It varies market by market, property by property, but it does happen. So compare that to the stock market. Next, let's talk a little bit about how to find opportunities in real estate. The markets change, conditions change. When the market was at the bottom after the 2008-9 crash, there were a lot of opportunities out there. It was quite easy to find a good deal. Today, it's very different. It's much, much harder to find a good deal in real estate. We work with a lot of heaviest hitters, top guys around the country, who are very strong marketers, and they find their deal flow through continuous, predictable, consistent marketing. And that's one of the ways to find opportunities. It is definitely possible to buy real estate at retail prices, get a good mortgage, and just ride the wave up. There's nothing fundamentally wrong with this. In many ways, if you got a great mortgage and you got decent cash flow, it's just a great long-term play. You don't need to do anything other than make the investment and stay passive for many years. We do combine two approaches. We actually invest for long-term, and we love that type of investing. Kind of buy it and forget it. If the opportunity is right, you can invest for 5-year horizon, 8-year horizon, almost no exit in mind. Most of our projects do have an exit strategy. But the way Warren Buffett talks a little bit about this, he wants to own the investment perpetually. The investment is strong. So from our perspective, we invest in those opportunities. Most of the projects we invest in are long-term value-add projects that have good cash flow to start with. But if you're looking for these projects, you can. There's many ways to find them. One is you could do your own marketing. Two, you could look for people who are good marketers, who have networks to find these opportunities, or you can invest in the funds. So I wanted to talk a little bit about small balance real estate funds, like some of our funds. Our flagship fund, Temple Opportunity Fund, is one of those funds. It's a growth and income fund. And there are many other funds, and I know many other fund managers who have very similar funds. They have niche markets, and they have great deal flow coming from their knowledge and experience and network. So finding these type of funds may be a way to get into these markets or sub-markets, take advantage of these great opportunities without trying to do some heavy lifting yourself, trying to find these deals, spending time and energy researching the market, marketing, and taking a risk. If you're not a professional investor, you don't know at times, what's a good opportunity. Just a quick word about comparing small balance real estate funds versus big institutional REITs. Big institutional REITs, the typically publicly traded companies, you could buy their stock on New York Stock Exchange and other markets. And they do pay a dividend. They pay often decent dividend, 4, 4.5, 5%, sometimes 6%. And these are not bad dividends at all. But their total return, their target, is nowadays significantly lower than the opportunities that often small funds can find. And the reason for this is big real estate investment trusts have a lot of capital, and they're dealing with a large amount of capital deployment problem rather than opportunity finding problem. So when they have so much capital to invest, they can't be choosy and picky on a small scale. They need big opportunities. And often big opportunities come with smaller returns. They often buy the properties or the projects we invest in the early stages for the value add component, and then they buy it retail because they need to put more money to work. To them, it's more important than trying to get maximized return on investment. The big difference is we typically come in at the early state of the project, the value add state of the project, and the REITs come in at the later stage of the project or property life cycle, effectively investing for yield, and they pay retail prices. So small balance real estate funds often have better opportunity to generate higher ROI and ROT on these projects. And typically, as I mentioned, they have a niche business or niche market. They also have fast responsiveness. Big REITs are typically a lot slower in their underwriting and deal-making process. Smaller funds can be much more nimble, and much more responsive. Also, small funds are managed by individuals whose network is a little bit more, let's call it dynamic. So these relationships in the dynamic networks, and I have one of those networks, is something that generates a lot of opportunities. So we invest virtually every single investment we make comes through our network. We take very little business from the street, and we take a majority of our business on referrals or from existing relationships with past track record. And also, small balance real estate funds have the opportunity to invest in smaller projects that are under the radar of the big boys and girls. In other words, big REITs that have $3 billion under management probably not looking at any investment opportunity less than $100 million. Just for the sake of this discussion, anything less than that would be a small target. For smaller funds like ours, we're pretty happy to look at small opportunities, couple million dollars. And these projects often have better returns than the big projects. Simply, the economy of scale drives the yields down, while the small projects have overall better investment ROI. And return on time, generally speaking, for big REITs is part of the problem. The reason they go for these big projects is because they need to have a good return on time. They don't have the luxury of spending a lot of time on these projects. That's why they settle for low ROI but higher ROT. And we often look for high ROI and somewhat low ROT, but it still has to meet our target numbers on the return on time phase. So you as an investor, you don't really care about ROT when you invest in a fund, but you do care about ROI. And we are able to generate investors better ROI by spending a little more time ourselves finding these opportunities and managing them. So the next topic, topic number six, I wanted to talk about is how to choose a smart real estate investment fund. We talked a little bit about these type of funds, and now we're going to talk about how to choose it. I do have a book out, and I'm not promoting the book because the book is available for free. If you are interested, it's available on Amazon. There's a small shipping and handling charge if you want a physical copy. And if you want a Kindle copy, it's available on Amazon. The book is called How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Investment Fund. It is something that I wanted to talk about. Let me just mention this on this podcast. I'll just cover the key topics, and then you can understand and appreciate why they're so important for you to know and understand before you make the investment. So number one topic, security of the investment. When you make an investment in a fund, you should understand their general investment model and why the security exists. What do they invest in? What type of assets and how they make sure that the investment is reasonably secure. Now, there's a big difference between the word secure investment and guaranteed investment. Guaranteed investment, typically government bonds and Bernie Madoff's products. So if you see these lovely words, guaranteed investment, be very careful. It's either something that generates pretty low yield and guaranteed by the US government or a major insurance company, or it could be a fraud. So security investment doesn't come from the guarantee. Security of investment comes from the management team experience and their track record. It comes from the asset model. It comes from the fund strategy. The next topic is return on investment. And return on investment typically has two components. One is cash flow, and two is appreciation. We talked a little bit about this. So overall, fund return could be, say, 13%, cash flow is 7%, and appreciation is 6%. Just be aware, this is the question to ask. When you hear a total return, ask how much of it is distributable as cash and how much of it comes as appreciation. Also, when you look at the return on investment, you should look at two components. One is what is the projected return based on the financial model, and two, what has been the historic return. So past results don't necessarily guarantee future performance, but at the same time, past results are indicative of future performance. They give an idea of what the future performance will look like. Again, it's not a guarantee, but at least you could see how the management team has done, how the fund has done in the past. So when you look at the ROI, look at the projected and the historic numbers, and as I mentioned, look at the income, cash on cash, realized gains, and look at the appreciation. The other element you should look at is income and taxation. So depending on the type of income that the fund generates, it may be taxed differently. What happens is when you invest in real estate and you own assets, or the fund invests in a bunch of long-term equity projects, the income comes in the form of cash flow generated from rents minus expenses. Also, income could come from other instruments. Like in our case, we have promissory notes, and the income comes in the form of interest. But the long-term assets that a fund owns do have depreciation schedules. So depreciation schedules can often create a significant deduction on the K-1 distributions for tax purposes. So when you look at the income generated, it's important to look at taxable income versus total income. So that's something that you should definitely pay attention. If you're investing IRA money, it doesn't make a difference. But if you're investing non-qualified money, non-IRA money, and it is subject to tax, having good depreciation deductions passing through as part of the fund distribution, that's definitely something you should look at. The next element you should consider, liquidity. Liquidity is something that you should always worry about. Generally speaking, liquidity comes in a fund form, comes from three sources. So liquidity comes from income that the fund generates. Liquidity comes from the fresh capital raised. So typically funds do raise capital. And then the other third element of the liquidity, it comes from the sale of the assets. So if the fund makes investments and some of the investments cycle back quickly, that generates high level of liquidity. So in our case, we invest in short-term bridge loans and hard money loans, fix and flip projects. And when these projects repay, we get liquidity back. Long-term assets have much less liquidity. So if we invest for 5 years, these projects don't have quick liquidity. They're designed to generate better return, but they have somewhat less liquidity. The next element of consideration are the fees. So every fund charges fees, or most of the funds charge management fees, performance fees, and you should look at how the fund manager makes money. And you're looking at two things. You're looking at sort of a fairness of the fees. If the fund manager generates great returns and the fees are high, that may be reasonable. At the same time, if the fund manager charges a lot of fees and returns are low, that's something that you should avoid. Also, you should look at the performance fees. So the higher the performance fees, the more incentives managers have to perform. So you should look at the management fees that keep the lights on, also performance fees. Most funds have a pref, or preferred return. It's very important to see some preferred return. Depending on the type of fund, it's reasonable in today's environment to have preferred returns anywhere between, say, 5 and 8%. And performance fees could vary. The splits could vary. Generally speaking, having a performance split on the nature of at least 50-50 all the way to 80-20 is typical. So what's the right number? It depends. Our fund, for example, our flagship fund, has a 7% pref and then 60-40 split, 70-30 on 80-20, depending on the type of units. So investors get actually bulk of the returns generated by the fund as a performance split. But the fund manager generates a performance fee, and it's really important to understand what it is. So you're looking at the historic numbers, and then you're looking at the fairness of the distribution of the type of pref that the fund pays and the split and the management fees. So these things are definitely something that you should look at before investing in a fund. The next area of consideration is frequency of the payout. Typically, funds have monthly payout or quarterly payout or annual payouts. We do quarterly payouts. There is nothing fundamentally wrong with annual payouts nor with monthly payouts. Monthly payouts is more work. Quarterly payouts feel just about right, and annual payouts probably not frequent enough. Annual payouts may be more applicable for funds that have a little bit longer term investments that have sort of limited liquidity on an ongoing basis. For us, it's a little different because most of the investments we make are focused on cash flow, and for us, quarterly payouts is the right number. The next area of consideration is management team experience. So as you're looking at any fund as a potential for your investment, you should look at the managers. What have they done in the past? What's been their track record? What kind of integrity they have, their personality, their communication skills, and so on and so forth. The next area of opportunity is quality of the deal flow for a given fund. So as you look at the investment in a fund, you should ask the managers, where are your deals coming from? How do you get your deals? How do you know these deals are good? You could also ask the questions, how many deals do you turn down? How many deals do you invest in that generate higher level of return, lower level of return? The next element of consideration is whether a fund is closed-ended or open-ended. The big difference is this. Closed-ended funds have a period of time when they raise capital, then they close, and then they ride those investments until the exits start. They start selling assets and liquidating, paying back investors the principal, and the income could be paid along the way and on the back end. The open-ended funds continuously raise capital. They continuously redeem shares for existing investors, and they continuously make new investments. So open-ended funds, also known as evergreen funds, are what we have in our flagship fund, Tempo Opportunity Fund, and our secondary fund, DF Investment Fund 2. I like the open-ended funds more because they provide ongoing flexibility, but there are specific projects that are much better suited for closed-ended funds. So there's no right or wrong. It's just a difference in the funds. And then the funds, overall fund strategy, what type of assets they invest in, how they get their deal flow, how they distribute the risk, how they diversify. Yeah, all those elements make the difference in the fund strategy. Is something that should be considered. Diversification is obviously the key to spread the risk and to increase the number of opportunities that could generate good returns, good cash flow, and diversification sort of is the mother of all risk strategies. On a final note, I wanted to say this: you work hard for your money, now let your money work hard for you. Invest and don't speculate. Thank you for your consideration and your time.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to BigMikeFund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike Zlotnick. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.